Parents of tweens, if you're familiar with far-off drop-offs...
Dad, stop, right here.
Or get DMs about what's for dinner, you may be experiencing tween milestones. For your son or daughter, these can start at age 9. HPV vaccination, a type of cancer prevention against certain HPV-related cancers, can start then too.
For most, HPV clears on its own. But for those who don't clear the virus, it can cause certain cancers later in life.
Embrace this phase. Help protect them in the next.
Ask their doctor today about HPV vaccination. Brought to you by Merck.
Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, evolocumab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Gives me great, great pleasure to welcome Sean O'Rourke to studio. Sean, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice day. Spring has almost sprung.
Yes.
And lots to be kind of looking forward to in the year ahead.
Well, good, good. Tell me this. How big an issue is the speaking rights row in your mind? How much does it matter to people?
Not as much as it did when it started.
Okay.
As it happens, I was in the Dáil just for about an hour and a half earlier today. Sat on the gallery for a while. I think I don't get exercised a lot by things that happen in politics because kind of like the RT thing, the statutory obligation not to give your own views. I mean, that's the way I operated. So I kind of professionally was required not to have opinions on things. But when that thing started and they wanted to give speaking rights to members effectively of the government, in other words, the Lowry crew, I did get incensed by it. And I thought, yeah, it was worth the walkout. It was worth the fuss. But over time, you know, they've been talking about it a lot. And just today I was there when Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, made the point, look, it's 8 minutes a week for, you know, a combination of these government supporting backbenchers and government backbenchers. Now, that's possibly oversimplifying it.
Yeah.
Because the question arises, that's to do with questions to the Taoiseach and Taoiseach. What about priority questions to ministers? What about members or membership of committees, committee chairs, all that kind of thing, you know, is still a little bit unclear. But I'm not sure that there's going to be a whole lot more public tolerance for continuing this row a whole lot longer, given what's happening in the country and the world.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask. I think, you know, if you accept, I think we all do, that a functioning parliament is important, then the rules that govern the parliament are important. So there is value in it in that regard. I think maybe some people, and this is maybe gauged as well from the text line on this show, found it a bit dispiriting that with all of those problems, the two biggest issues that the Dáil has been preoccupied with have been speaking rights and whether a Ginchint Breaga translates directly as telling lies or telling untruths.
The row, I think, has damaged the government, but it's not going to damage it anymore.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of a lingering thing that, look, they were seen as being too clever by half at the start, and they brought this on themselves, and they brought a lot of derision, and I think people could see through this business of Micheál Martin saying, oh, you know, this undermines the constitution, and getting all po-faced about it. I don't think it did. I think they were caught on pulling a stroke in the old-fashioned sense of that. But look, time to move on now.
So the way politics is covered by the media has kind of changed profoundly since you started working. Has politics itself changed?
Well, yes and no. I mean, obvious changes are in the way we cover it. First of all, when I started, it was 1980. You didn't even have audio of the proceedings transmitted. You had the newspapers and RT used to have three people on what was called a take, and they used to kind of do verbatim reports and then they would be summarised. Initially, radio was brought in and then television, and then there was no going back. That's one thing. But I mean, the way, you know, when I covered it, mainly I was up as Paul Carr of the Irish Press in the 1980s, and that was the Fitzgerald Haughey era, and it was, you know, a battle a day, and Labour were in on it as well on the opposition side, with people like Frank Klusky, Dick Spring. That level of kind of naked contention and opposition, no matter what the government did, it was wrong, it was to be fought over. That's all over. There's much more consensus about it now. Obviously, the two big rivals, you know, on the opposite side of the Dáil, well, they, as some people predicted at the time and argued should happen, I'm thinking of the late Professor John Kelly being the foremost on this, that really, there wasn't a whole lot between them. They should get together. And rolling on a bit, I remember I used to occasionally meet PJ Mara and some other people involved in politics for an odd lunch. And I remember putting it to PJ, oh, this is going back maybe 15 years or more. Look, if it came to it and you had to decide between going into government, this was now long after the core value had been cast aside and Fianna Fáil were making deals and going to coalition. If you had to choose between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin as a partner, what would you do? And he kind of took a bit of a breath and he said, I think I'd go with the Blues. In other words, Fine Gael. But ultimately, I can see down the road, depending, it all comes back to the numbers, Kieran, and it's going to be, like, don't rule out Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, certainly Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, you know, very much a possibility. It just depends on the circumstances and time.
Why do you think we so far then have been immune to what we've seen in other jurisdictions, but not all jurisdictions, whereby kind of the political divide has got more stark between parties?
Well, has you know, it? I mean, is there a whole lot? Is there a whole lot separating them? I mean, you know, you saw the consensus last year on the referendum on definition of the family and rights of the child and so forth like that. And with the exception of Aintu, they were all on the one side and offside with the people. And similarly on the social issues, they used to be at it hammer and tongs on issues back in the day, no longer. So, you know, I'm not sure that you can say there is a massive divide. Okay,
but there's a more profound divide, or there's certainly a kind of a tangible sense of tribalism that doesn't exist or doesn't seem to exist here.
Yeah, well, the biggest change I was going to say, and maybe this is part of the tribalism thing, is the arrival of Sinn Féin. I mean, when I was covering it in the 80s, I mean, like, there was a big row in the Dáil restaurant because Phil Flynn, who was then a vice president of Sinn Féin and a leading trade union leader, had been brought in to the Dáil restaurant, I think by the late Brendan McGahan, who happened to be from Loud as well.
Yeah.
And there was uproar over it. And, you know, it was the time of Section 31. There were no Sinn Féin TDs. And then 1997, they had one. Cuí No Caolán was the first one. And over that time, I mean, they've now, you know, gradually they have grown and grown and built and built, and they've got some very, I mean, whatever you say about them, whatever you say about their background, they are professionals.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they scare the living daylights out of Fianna Fáil in electoral terms.
Because they're becoming Fianna Fáil?
Well, yeah, arguably, yes. I mean, they are. Well, they're certainly appealing to the kind of voters that Fianna Fáil would have
been
on the terraces and in the working class areas.
They're not a million miles away from Bertie Ahern's Fianna Fáil, to put it that way.
Yeah, in terms of how they go about their business, and, you know, putting in the hard yards, and, you know, they bring a seriousness to their politics that. Is, you know, it goes be, it's they're not amateurs. It's not something they do part time.
No,
they're very serious, and they're ruthless about the way they treat their own people as well. If you're not performing, if you're not delivering, we saw what happened in Derry. You get dumped.
Yeah, but at the same time, every now and then something comes along that drags us back into the past, be it kind of a Bobby Storey funeral or Bick McFarlane as well.
And I thought it was very interesting this week. You saw Mary Lou McDonald's very warm tribute to Bick McFarlane. Now, bearing in mind, you know, his role, for instance, in the kidnapping of Don Tidy and the murder of Private Kelly and the guard Gary Sheehan, you know, anybody could have foreseen this was going to draw the ire of the government parties on her. And sure enough, it happened. But, you know, it's something that she obviously feels she has to do in order to protect her own position with the Sinn Féin base, in the same way as, roll back, you know, a couple of decades, Gerry Adams carrying the coffin of Thomas Begley, the bomber on the Shankill Road, which caused John Major to say, you know, it churned his stomach to see those pictures of Adams carrying the bomber, the bomber's coffin. And Albert Reynolds explained to him a few days later at a summit in Brussels, in the, on Mars, as they say, if Adams didn't carry that coffin, he could have been in the next one himself.
Yeah.
They do what they have to do.
Is there a generational divide, do you think, in the Dáil in terms of the level of disgust? Do you know, it always strikes me, Micheál Martin strikes me as somebody who genuinely finds it problematic, really finds it problematic when he hears Mary Lou McDonald kind of lauding the likes of Bic McFarlane. I just wonder whether, when you kind of go down the age ranks within the parties, whether they think it's that big a deal.
I suspect they don't. And it does, you know, like when you realise what some of these guys did, and a lot of them, and the associations that they have, but you've got to ask yourself, you know, and you might have to do things, you know, which involve holding your nose. I mean, like, where is condemnation going to get you, an incessant reminding of people? Because, you know, ultimately, you know, and you can say, look, you know, it's a joke and it's an aberration that Gerry Adams would deny that he was ever in the IRA. Well, who believes that? But the fact of the matter is, you know, do you continue to decry him by virtue of all that he was associated with, or do you actually make space for him to bring those people into the political process? And, you know, unpalatable though it may be, you deal with them as people like Blair. And of course, Major did it in back channels. You could say, there's some people who say Thatcher did it through back channels. They deal with them.
Was that, you know, people have often accused the Southern government, if we'll use that phrase, of maybe a degree of double standards, that there was an expectation in the North, you have to deal with people, bring them into the head, but we don't want to do it down here. On some level, was that just politics? That they saw, as you say, you know, particularly Fianna Fáil, they saw the threat that Sinn Féin posed.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, look at Paisley. I mean, you know, he wouldn't sit in the same studio as members of the Southern government, let alone members of Sinn Féin. He ended up doing business with Martin McGuinness. They developed quite an extraordinary relationship. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that, you know, Sinn Féin have, what is it, 38 TDs now? And, you know, they have the most gender balanced parliamentary party of the lot. And they, you know, it's just a question of when the numbers come right.
Yeah.
And then they'd be necessary. I mean, like, it started a long time ago in the local government council chambers. They do deals. And it's just a question of working up.
The other big domestic political issue comes from abroad, which is going to be the impact of any tariffs imposed on this country by the Trump administration. Whether he's just talking about them with a view to something else, or whether they actually get input, we don't know. That's the kind of the great mystery always with Donald Trump. How do you engage, or how do you process his hyperbole? Do you take it at face value, or do you try and work out what he means behind it? Do you try and ignore it?
I'm watching with a mixture, to borrow that phrase, of shock and awe. I mean, on several fronts, be it climate change, you know, banning offshore, you know, drill, baby, drill, pull out of the Paris Agreement. That's one thing. Look at, you know, what he's been saying about Gaza, and his capacity to just fire, it would appear, through Mr. Musk, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of public servants at will. Mm. I mean, it is just so alien to our way of doing things on this side of the Atlantic. I am fascinated. I mean, you know, people call him a disruptor. I mean, what he's doing on Ukraine. I mean, I think suddenly, and, you know, like, he seems to be, I don't know about the legality or otherwise, in years to come at some international court, of the deal that he has foisted on Zelensky, who, as we speak, is when he's away from Shannon, where he met me on Martin, over to Washington. I mean, that clearly is a deal being done under duress. But the kind of movement that Trump has engendered by the phone call to Putin, the talks in Saudi, that he suddenly woken up the Europeans, you know, we can't just let this thing drift on in a state of stalemate. And I mean, there are shocking things happening. You see Britain increasing its defence spending at the cost of its aid to the poorest people in the world through their foreign aid. But you get a sense that maybe there will be the kind of movement and some deal done. Again, it's one of these ones that a lot of people will probably be holding their noses. There may be an earlier end to what's happening in Ukraine. Not one that anybody is going to be particularly proud of, but it as a result of what Trump has done, people will be jolted into making and facing up to decisions and settlements now or in the next, say, 6-12 months that might otherwise have taken 5 or 10 years.
So there's something to be said for the art of the deal, is there?
Well, there may well be, but I am not, to use one of Michael McDowell's borrowed phrases, a snake in regarder of Trump. I mean, I did what might be considered in a minor way an infamous interview with him in
2014, was it?
2014. But look, you know,
I met him in 2014 in Doonbeg when you were there. Right. I was there, and we were staying nearby, and we went into the pro shop, and he was there. So my son is listening. He said, "I had a beautiful baby."
Well, you know, I was fascinated by him at several levels. The way his own children, his family, and his employees kind of related to him. They weren't fawning. They were, I suppose, respectful. I was fascinated by how strong he was about, you know, sort of being anti-drugs, anti-drink, based on his own family experience. We didn't part on the friendliest of terms. He wouldn't pose for a picture. But then, as it happened, I met him out in the course a couple of hours later, and he was quite friendly. He actually said he stood and watched a few of us teeing off, and he, as I hit the ball down the middle of the fairway, he said, "Nice swing." Now, whatever you say about my golf, I don't have a nice swing. But it was another piece of his plausible.
Proof you can't believe a thing he says.
Plausible hyperbole on his part, you know, which he engages in quite a bit.
So with all of this going on, I know you've got the insights, the podcast. Do you miss the daily cut and thrust?
No.
No?
I'll tell you why.
Why?
I think it was 19 years on the Daily News at 1 in RT. I had another 7 with a 2-hour live show from 10 o'clock to 12. And I can honestly say I loved every minute of it. The Today Show, when a very respected colleague defected to these parts, one Mr. Pat Kenny, still going strong, and I'm in awe of him for being able to do that. That was fantastic. It was a break that I got that I never expected to get. It allowed me to work on a much bigger canvas and meet more interesting people, do longer interviews, you know, sort of be it sport, be it culture, be it music, all that stuff. And it was fantastic. And but it took a lot out of me. Gay Byrne met my wife, Caroline worked for Gay back in the day as a producer. And he said, "Oh, I listened to himself. And does he realise how relentless it is?" And that is the one word that describes. Yeah. I mean, you know it yourself. I wouldn't have been the best sleeper. And I began to sleep a bit less when I started that.
Okay.
But I always found, look, when that red light goes on, you say to yourself, "I can get through the next 2 hours." And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you get through the week. Great. But when it stopped, you know, there was another life to be lived. Obviously, I follow the news not as intently as I used to. But there are other things in life. There are children, there are grandchildren, you know, there are sports.
There's golf.
There's a bit of that too, yeah. I had a great time. I had a fantastic innings. And like other people come along, you know, everybody, like I won't say everybody's going to get their shot, but other people deserve a chance.
Graveyards are full of irreplaceable men, is that it?
Absolutely. And, you know, the listeners and viewers are entitled to see and hear other people. And again, the one thing I think I did prove, or that was proven after Pat left, was nobody is indispensable. I mean, we held the numbers, they went up, they went back and forth a bit, but there was no big loss, you know, and it was the RT brand, it wasn't the individual. So that mightn't have been great for presenters negotiating salaries, but that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, a whole other topic. Listen, it's been great to chat to you, Sean. Thanks a million for coming into us.
You too, enjoyed it.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.
Parents of tweens, if you're familiar with far-off drop-offs...
Dad, stop, right here.
Or get DMs about what's for dinner... You may be experiencing tween milestones. For your son or daughter, these can start at age 9. HPV vaccination, a type of cancer prevention against certain HPV-related cancers, can start then too.
For most, HPV clears on its own. But for those who don't clear the virus, it can cause certain cancers later in life.
Embrace this phase. Help protect them in the next.
Ask their doctor today about HPV vaccination. Brought to you by Merck.